This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To, Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you as always for the next hour. You are listening to the show live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or you are tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the show, and of course you're doing that at horseracingradio.net. Well, today's guest has been training on his own since 2012. He has saddled 59 winners, which includes a trio of greatest stakes victories. But his career and his life might look completely different today if not for a horse named Riverside Theater and one very lucky day at England's Cheltenham Festival 8 years ago. Please join me in welcoming trainer Connor Murphy to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Connor, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Mike, and appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, looking forward to hearing your story. And it starts first and foremost with that winning wager that you picked up 8 years ago when Riverside Theater crossed the finish line first at Cheltenham. Take me back to that day.
Yeah, so look, I suppose, you know, for I know a lot of your listeners will, you know, a lot of them will know about the Cheltenham Festival. Maybe, you know, it's probably the equivalent of the Breeders' Cup of steeplechasing. I suppose is the best I can give it as a similarity. You know, I was lucky enough to be second head lad for Nicky Henderson, who's, you know, champion trainer in England, and. You know, Cheltenham, the whole season revolved around those 4 days, you know. The Cheltenham Festival was, you know, that was the target for all the horses. And we'd have anywhere between 30 and 40 runners over the 4 days. So it was chaotic. It was chaotic from the point of view of, you know, you're just working, concentrating on everything. But obviously a lot of the lads that have a few bets on as well. So that Thursday, the Riverside won the Ryanair. I mean, listen, sure, we'd had four winners the day before, and I suppose we celebrated hard that Wednesday night. So I won't lie to you, I was fairly critical with a hangover that Thursday. So it was fairly blurry as regards that morning, but. Look, the race, I think the race was on around maybe 2:50 in the afternoon. And the race itself, geez, I tell you, you know, to probably be fair to say that not much went right for the horse in the race, you know. But he kept finding, and I mean, it was a brilliant ride the same day, and to win the race, it was just it was unbelievable, really. I mean, it was. Is a feeling that's hard to explain. Definitely life-changing, like you said, you know.
Yeah, it was. And let's set the proper context here for all of our listeners. And this was a bet, Connor, that you didn't make the bet the day of the race. You had to make this bet 4 months prior to the Cheltenham Festival. So we're talking about the festival in 2012. You had to place the bet in December of 2011, and you didn't have to win one race. You had to pick five horses and win five individual races, a pick five, if you will, in order to win this bet. It's called an accumulator over in Cheltenham. So how did you know that these were the five horses? But you didn't. You had no idea. But how did you come up with the five horses?
Well, I was very lucky to be, first of all, have the job I did in the yard I did, but also even more so lucky than the fact that we had, it was almost a golden era of horses the time I was there. I mean, listen, Sprinter Sacra, he'll probably go down as one of the greatest steeplechasers of all time. You know, we had a lot of talent. Simon Sieg, we thought, was, you know, as good, if not better, than Sprinter, believe it or not, at the time. So we had a lot of nice horses in the yard. So I suppose, you know, I felt, look, Sprinter Sacra, you know, I made the best. I want to say it was maybe the 23rd of December 2011, because Sprinter was actually going to Kempton 4 days later for the Wayward Lad, which he was taking on a horse called Peddler's Cross, who'd been second in the previous season's champion hurdle. And Peddler's Cross was going to be a hot favourite, but, you know, we were fairly confident that Sprinter would take a lot of beating. So I suppose I made the best before the race to get the better odds. But, of course, look, any punter or handicapper around the world, Mike, you know yourself, will tell you, you know, when you're making a bet, you don't expect to see the money again, you know, and especially a bet like that. But no, I mean, yes, the Sprinter was 9-1. If my memory serves me right, he was 9-1 for the Arc Lenti Post, which, you know, we knew that if he won the race at Kempton 4 days later, he'd probably be favourite. So. So, yeah, he was the first one in there. And then, like I said, Simon Sieg, we thought was a very, very good horse. And probably, I think, it's probably fair to say Barry Geraghty, our stable jockey at the time, he was probably the one that got him most excited. You know, it's hard to say that when we had Sprinter, but, you know, Simon Sieg was a seriously good race horse. You know, he was never able to show his full, his true ability due to injuries over the years. But, you know, he was a young horse coming through that we thought would take a lot of beating at Cheltenham. So he was second in there. Bobsworth, we came at him from a point of view that he doesn't do much at home. You know, he never did much at home, never did much in the mornings. Smallish horse for a steeplechaser, but he'll tell you what, I don't think there was a horse in the yard who had a heart as big as him. And you know, he'd won the previous season's Albert Bartlett Novices Hurdle, gone three miles, and we felt if he got to Cheltenham in one piece, he'd have a massive chance in the RSA. And you know, he was a tricky horse. When I say a tricky horse, after Christmas, things got tricky with him for a spell. But he came, you know, he got there in the end. And then Finian's Rainbow, he was fourth on the list. He's probably the horse. I actually have that horse here in Kentucky now, believe it or not. He was a horse that I rode every day and had a very close affiliation with. And, you know, he was going in the champion chase. And, you know, Sizing Europe was the reigning champion. And, you know, he was going to be a hard horse to beat. But we felt Finian's had been second in the previous season's Arkle. But he was a very keen horse in his novice chase year. But he'd relaxed a lot. And, you know, we felt he could throw down a big challenge to Sizing Europe if he got there on the day. And then obviously Riverside Theatre was the fifth horse. And, you know, I'll be straight up, Mike, the reason I put Riverside Theatre in is because he was a horse who went very, very well when he was fresh. You know, he had fractured his pelvis the season before, and he'd come in late. So I honestly thought that we wouldn't get a race into him before Cheltenham, that he'd go straight to the festival. And that's why I put him in there, because I said, you know, if he can get to Cheltenham fit and off a layoff, he'd have a massive chance, because there wasn't many better. I don't think there is any better than my old boss, Nicky Henderson, at getting one ready for Cheltenham, especially off a long break, you know. And as it turned out, Riverside went to Ascot a month before Cheltenham, and he jumped and travelled and won easily. And I kind of resigned myself to him winning at Cheltenham after that, because, like I say, he was a horse who went best when he was fresh. And I mean, the race itself that day, he never travelled. He didn't jump as well as he can, but you know, he kept going. And Barry gave him a brilliant ride, but also the horse, fair play to the horse. I mean, he kept finding for pressure as well, you know. But yeah, so it was brilliant. But sure, look, when the bet was made, sure, the chance of all five even getting to the Cheltenham Festival was a long shot at that stage, you know.
Yeah, a long shot indeed. As a matter of fact, I had read where you calculated the odds of hitting this wager around 64,000 to 1. And we kind of buried the lead a little bit here, Connor. By the way, visiting with Connor Murphy here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton, we kind of buried the lead in that I neglected to mention that the reason that this wager was so significant, and the reason it changed your life completely and led you to where you are now training horses here in the United States, is because of the fact that your 50-pound wager 4 months prior to the festival, which was about $75 U.S., returned roughly $1.5 million, which helped you, well, obviously get the money to establish your own thoroughbred stable here in the United States. So this wager that we're talking about not only was a significant score for you, but changed your life completely.
Oh yeah, without question. I mean, you know, I had planned, you know, my wife is from here, so you know, I had planned to move back to the States that summer. Sure, look, I suppose you couldn't ask for a better kickstart there than winning that bet, you know. No, it was a huge it was a life changing, simple as that. I mean, you know, I suppose a loan to be able to, you know, just to be able to buy a house, I mean, that, you know, that's just you know, not to have to worry about, you know, getting a mortgage, everything else like that, or finding a place, you know, just to be able to buy a house, let alone kickstart anything else, was huge, you know.
Why the United States? Why were you so anxious to come here to start your stable as opposed to staying in England?
I just felt the opportunities were greater here, Mike. I mean, listen, as you can probably tell from the horses that I do, the few horses I do train, you know, they're all ex-European horses, because, you know, look, I love, you know, jump racing first and foremost is, you know, has always been and still is my passion, you know. You know, I grew up in West Cork in Ireland, and, you know, County Cork in particular is, you know, point-to-point central almost. And, you know, it's just, I suppose it's in my blood, simple as that. And... you know, the flat racing at home I absolutely love as well, but it's just tough. You know, unless you've a lot of money behind you, it's tough. It's tough going in Ireland and England also. I mean, you know, Ireland, you've got obviously on the flat Aidan O'Brien and his two sons now as well. I mean, sure, listen, it's not getting any easier. And you know, Ger Lyons is a top trainer there as well, but. And Dermot Weld, etc. But, you know, and over jumps, you've got Willie Mullins and Gordon Elliott. So it's tricky from the point of view that you don't have as many options, and wherever you go, you're going to bump into the big boys, you know. There are a lot more options in England, but the prize money is fairly pathetic. No, I have no problem in saying that. For one of the top countries racing in the world, the prize money is just not good enough, simple as that, you know. So over here, I just felt, you know, you obviously much bigger country, a lot more racetracks, and you know, just trying. It just gives you a better opportunity, you know.
Connor, what do you think your life and your career would look like today if you hadn't won that bet 8 years ago?
Jeez, I'd probably, you know, I suppose, listen, there's no doubt I probably wouldn't have had the opportunity to buy some nicer horses. So I doubt I'd still be training. If I, you know, even if I had started when I had planned on it, I don't know how long it would have lasted. You know, it wouldn't have lasted anywhere near as long as it has anyway, that's for sure. You know, luckily, I was able to buy a couple of, you know, Dimension. He was the first horse I bought when I came over here, and you know, he was a brilliant horse for us over the years, and you know, we've had a few other nice horses since. So definitely wouldn't have had the opportunity to train a couple of nice horses for other than that, you know.
You mentioned your wife, and you mentioned her being from the United States. She was one of the people, and you had people watching. You had people watching the Cheltenham Festival and cheering you on all over the world, from Dubai to the United States, and certainly there in England. Tell me about how you met your wife and how that all came about.
Met my wife. She must be 14 years ago, I'd say, in Lexington after I think it was opening weekend, the Keeneland's fall meet actually. But and you know, she we started dating, and she came over to England with me, and she was there for a couple of years, and she you know, decided it wasn't for her, and she came back here. So we did long distance for a while, and then sure, you know, obviously, you know, I decided to move back here to start training then. So, but yeah, that's about it, really.
Yeah, and then you had your friend Justin, Justin Curran, who was watching the race at a bar in Dubai and cheering you on from Dubai.
Yeah, you know, I didn't tell many people, Mike. I mean, Julie knew, and Justin and my brother, possibly two of my brothers, definitely one anyway, and there was a couple of people in the yard itself knew, but I didn't tell many people because I wouldn't be the type of person to be giving away too much information of what I've done, but sure, you know yourself, you tell one lad in the yard and all of a sudden there was 10 people coming up to me before the race saying, I hope the horse wins. So yeah, it's you know yourself, whether it is Ireland or England or America, once you're in a racing barn, it is like wildfire, these little rumours, but whether they're true or not. But anyway, no, sure, look, it was great. It was mighty altogether, you know.
So let's fast forward then. So you win the bet. You decide you're going to come to the United States to start training on your own. You buy a few horses in England, Dimension being one of them, who you talked about a second ago, and we'll talk more about him because he was so integral in the early part of your career. But take me through the progression then. How does it work after you win the bet? You start buying the horses. Take me through that timeline and that period of your life.
Well, I mean, I won the bet in March, obviously, and you know, obviously, you got to, you know, at the time, you know, before I won the bet, even I was kind of looking at my visa options, you know, I suppose what the bet allowed me to do most was get a 5-year visa to make a business investment, you know, as a business visa. So, you know, that kind of, the next few months, everything was kind of, you know, I was still working in Henderson's, and I stayed there till July. You know, I moved over here, I think it was early September, but, you know, I'd been kind of looking all summer. I'd been looking all summer at horses because, you know, even though I'd worked here in the past, I didn't know, I didn't know many people as regards, you know, owners. So there was no point in me coming over here saying I'm a horse trainer because I wasn't going to get any horses. So I felt if I could buy, one or two decent horses just to, you know, help get the name out there. And we do, you know, do a lot of breaking and pre-training also, which we still do, that we could get some numbers in. But so that's how, I mean, that's how it went. I mean, Dimension was the first one in, and luckily enough, through David Carroll, who I had worked with previously, he was, you know, kind enough to, you know, any yearlings he has to break in, he sent the owners our way. And you know, we had another couple of yearlings from other people as well, so it worked out. It worked out where we had a barn full of horses anyway, even though, you know, we might have had 20 horses and only three of them were going to be trained by me, but sure, at least it was work anyway, you know.
Yeah, talk about the relationship with David Carroll, because he played a major role in helping you get started as well, didn't he?
I did, yeah. No, David was very good. I mean, you know, he was a gentleman to work for. When I did work for him, it was probably due to the job opportunity I had with Nicky Henderson. It didn't, you know, I didn't work for him very long, but, you know, I enjoyed it, and we became good friends and still are good friends, and we talk quite a bit. But, yeah, he was a big help in getting me... you know, any yearlings he could, or any owners to send my way, he was kind enough to do so. And, you know, I'll forever be grateful to him for that. And sure, listen, you know, whether you're starting out here or anywhere else, to get those first few horses in is the toughest part, you know.
Yeah, I think the world of David Carroll. I can remember when I was working at Keeneland years and years ago, David was one of the first people I met, and he was always so personable, and he was always so welcoming every time you would see him. And he really had a tremendous run for quite some time there. He had it rolling. And then now he's working with Mark Cassie, I believe, isn't he? Is Mark's assistant?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, he's Mark Cassie's right-hand man there, and he's, I'd say he's probably happier now than he was when he was training, I'd imagine. And I can see, I don't blame him, but sure looked as, no, he's he was a big help, so I'll always be grateful for that, you know.
Yeah, being the head man, being the head trainer, as opposed to a right-hand man, as you said, or assistant trainer, whatever it might be, it's totally different when you're the one in charge. You're the one responsible for all of the business elements, for all of the equine elements, keeping the horses healthy. The whole thing changes when you're the man in charge, doesn't it, Connor?
Oh, massively, yeah, massively. I mean, look, like I say, you know, I was, you know, when I was working in Henderson's eggs, for example, you know, you'd be thinking, you know, so the head man and the head man and in England and Ireland is like it would be the equivalent to the assistant over here. You know, they do everything in the yard, checking legs and everything like that. The assistants over there would be the ones going racing. You know, obviously it's not like here where you're stabled at the track, so you just walk up with the horse, you know. So 'tis a lot different, but I mean I loved the job with Nicky, because, you know, just checking legs every night was huge. You know, you almost know horses' legs like the back of your hands, you know, and you learn a lot. And I was lucky enough to, Corky Brown was the head man there, and I learned a lot off him, you know. I can't tell you how much I learned off him, and also we're still great friends as well. We talk a good bit, but you know, at the end of the day, we were able to go home and pick up our paycheck and go home, and that was it, you know. I mean, you'd still be thinking about things at work, but you didn't have to worry about do I have enough money in my bank account to pay my staff this week, kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it's a different thing.
It's a huge, huge difference, you know.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And Nicky Henderson, one of the premier national hunt trainers in the game, talk a little bit more about Nicky and the approach to training there.
Just listen, brilliant trainer, very, very patient. Great. I mean, lucky. He was lucky. He'll tell you himself. He's lucky to have the best owners, and that they'll, you know, they'll, if they need to give a horse a year, he can. They'll allow him to do that. You know, and that's, you know, I suppose, giving a horse time was the main thing. And I mean, probably the one thing that I probably do a lot myself that doesn't, it probably doesn't help me is, you know, if give a horse plenty of time to develop, or, you know, if it picks up an injury, back off it for a few months, whatever, you know, it's just, but he always did right by the horse, and he was, you know, a very hands-on trainer, just a very, very good trainer all around. You know, he was there every day, out every lot watching the horses train. And he, you know, the whole season was primed around Cheltenham. You know, the horses, they'd improve at each run throughout the year. And if, you know, some of the better horses, like the Grade One horses, they might be prime for a King George, but then he'd back off him for 6 weeks and go again and have him spot on for Cheltenham, you know.
Yeah, patience is a word that comes up quite often on this show when I ask trainers to describe their philosophy or what the key might be to being a good trainer, and that word patience always comes up in that conversation. And it sounds like Nicky Henderson was the king of patience and giving horses time and letting them develop on their own.
Oh yeah, no, hugely. And you know, we'd look round the yard probably three, maybe even four nights a week. He'd look round the yard with the two headmen and the two assistants, and every lad would have the horse held up in the stall with the blankets off. And you know, you just get to see, and he'd see himself, you know, how the horse is doing weight wise and everything. And you know, his attention to detail was unbelievable. You know, you know, if there was a horse needed this or that, he'd say it. You know, but you know, it was just, the patience was definitely the big thing with him. You know, brilliant man for doing right by the horse. And you know, if it needed a year, he'd give it a year, no problem whatsoever, you know.
Visiting with trainer Connor Murphy here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. When I come back, we are going to talk about some of the horses that have had an impact on his career, and we'll talk about some of the other people that helped him along the way. He is on a roll right now. He's trainer Connor Murphy, and he's with me on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Back right after this.
From America's number one auction company by percentage of Grade One winners sold, including these selected yearling graduates: Bast, Four Wheel Drive, Honor AP, Perfect Alibi, Rushing Fall, Sharing, Speech, and Tis the Law, comes an unprecedented showcase of quality. 662 selected yearlings in one extraordinary catalog. The Fasig Tipton Selected Yearling Showcase, September 9th and 10th, after the Derby in Lexington, Kentucky.
Live racing is back at Woodbine. Visit woodbine.com to watch live feeds and check out their Stellar Stakes program, which includes $13.8 million in purses across 75 stakes. The Canadian Triple Crown begins with the 161st running of the Queen's Plate on Saturday, September 12th. The Grade 1 Rico Woodbine Mile, a win and you're in for the Breeders' Cup, is set for Saturday, September 19th. Visit woodbine.com for more information. Woodbine, a new breed of experience.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, all presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you as always here on the program. If you missed any portion of the first half of the show, my interview with trainer Connor Murphy, and I'll continue that interview here in just a minute, but all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net, to check out the podcast. You can listen at your leisure, or you can follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook and on Instagram. We started the interview and the show this afternoon by talking about a wager, a significant wager that Connor Murphy won 8 years ago in 2012, and it changed his life. It gave him $1.5 million. That doesn't hurt, but it also gave him the opportunity to follow his dream and to come to the United States to buy a few horses and to start training horses on his own. We'd also talked about some of the people that helped him along the way. And there have been plenty of people that have helped Connor get to this point. And now we're going to talk about how Connor Murphy approaches training racehorses and what his philosophy is. So Connor, let's start the second half of the show by answering that question. What do you do? What is your philosophy, your approach when you get set to train horses?
Again, I suppose not wanting to go back to the word we used before the break there, but patience, you know. We try and have the horses where they're going to improve with each run. A lot of horses obviously might get hurt or whatever and they'll only end up having a run, but, you know, I suppose we just take our time with them and let have them fit enough first time where they're going to run a big race, but also, and hopefully win, but also where you're going to have where there's going to be plenty of improvement to come to, and just have them improve with every run throughout the year. And obviously the lesser horses, and I have plenty of them, believe me. You try and have them fairly ready first time, but the few better ones I have, you try and just have them improve with each run throughout the year, where they're hitting their best form around this time of year, the next couple of months, really, you know.
How many horses do you have now, Connor?
I have 15 at the moment. We're here in Skylight Training Centre with all 15, so that's good. I mean, it's a great place for great environment for horses, very relaxing. And they do good here, you know.
When you have a smaller operation, and yeah, I'll go back to the word we used to end the first half of the program, patience. Every good horse trainer that I've had on this show says patience is a key. You said the same thing. Is it harder to be patient when you only have 15 horses?
It is harder, but I mean, you know, I think I used to look at it as plain and simple. I mean, do what's best for the horse, and just obviously you'd love to be running every couple of weeks, but it's just you've got to stick to your plan. Stick to your plan in that, you know, whatever race you have in mind for a horse, just stick to it. And there'll be times when you're tempted to run it a bit sooner, but I don't find it pays off too much anyway.
How is Connor Murphy a different trainer today than you were, say, 8 years ago when you first started down this road?
I could answer that question a lot of ways. I suppose as a trainer, you learn over the years through experience. You never stop learning, but you do learn over, a few years, training 8 years now, and I suppose you try and be a bit more realistic with certain horses, definitely, but also, if a horse, one of the biggest mistakes I made I had a couple of horses who were running very well towards the end of the year, and I decided I'd give them the winter off to do right by the horse, give them a break, and a couple of those horses never came back, so you just have to, with those lesser quality horses, when they're on a roll, you definitely have to keep going,
That's a good lesson.
I suppose if it was easy, there'd be a lot more trainers in the world, but there are a hell of a lot out there already, but you definitely have a lot more if it was easier than it is, you know.
Well, that's a great point. Why would somebody choose to be a horse trainer for a living and essentially work 365 days a year, get up early every single morning, and dedicate their entire life to that profession. Why would you do it, Connor? What's so rewarding about it?
Mike, I ask myself that. I ask myself that question every morning. Why do I do it? To self-torture, I suppose. But not to listen to the passion. Sure, it's like a drug, isn't it? I mean, they're just you could be going bad, and then you have a winner, and that winner is like, you know, that adrenaline is just sure listening. That's what it's all about at the end of the day. My bank balance and everything else will tell you that it's not good for you. But sure, to listen to the passion, there's no doubt about that. That's why we do it, you know.
What else would you be doing if you weren't training horses?
I don't know anything else, Mike, if I'm being totally honest. You know, I just worked with horses all my life, and I literally don't know what else I would do. Because believe me, there's, you know, we've had a rough couple of years now, and there's times when I'm thinking, you know, how long more can I do this? And, you know, it's all very well when you're on your own, but when you've got a wife and two young kids to support, it's a big difference. I genuinely, it's a question I've thought about a lot, but I can't give you an answer. You know, I've thought about a lot of things, but there's nothing I can come up with.
How does a trainer persevere through difficult times like that, Connor? You said you had a couple of years that were kind of rough, and I think every trainer, no matter how good you are, goes through that patch in their career, maybe even a few times. How do you persevere through the down times?
Just say survival. That's what it's all about. I mean, that's all I can say. You just get by. It's tough going. I mean, listen, there are 90% maybe, it might be too much, maybe, but 75% of the trainers in this country, I would say, are struggling on a daily basis. You know, it's just a day by day, and you know, I'm one of them. There's no doubt. And look, I've no problem saying my, you know, the one thing in Ireland or England, if you have a nice horse that wins a couple of nice races or runs a couple of nice races, you know, you're seen. It's a good job, you know. But over here, there's no doubt. It's all about the win percentage, and I've no problem in saying my win percentage isn't good enough for owners to be calling me, sending me horses, you know. You know, before I started training, I kind of had this thing, I would prefer train 6 or 7 good horses than have 20 horses where half of them were claiming 5 or whatever. But unfortunately, and I had this conversation with Sean Clancy the other day, I said, you know, when you've got better horses, and I don't have a lot of good horses, don't get me wrong, but even when you've allowance horses, you're running in better races and they're tougher to win, so your win percentage suffers as a consequence. So, you know, you start to look at things differently, no doubt about it, you know.
Yeah, it's a great point, and you're right. I think so many people, so many owners, when they start looking for a trainer, the first thing they look at is win percentage, because owners want to win. They want to get return on their investment too. But there are a lot of trainers like yourself that have smaller operations that are, you know, working with horses that aren't the same caliber as, say, a Steve Asmussen barn or a Todd Pletcher barn or Bob Baffert barn, whatever it might be. And it's a whole different ball game when you're working at that level, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. And I mean, you know, listen, I'm very lucky to have the bunch of owners I have, because they're very loyal for the most part, and they're very, you know, they're very patient as well, and they know that I'm going to take my time with a horse, and they're very good to, they just let me get on with it. So I am very lucky to have owners like that. But I mean, if I see a horse that I like, and I buy it, like I actually bought a horse in Newmarket today now, and I'll be trying to sell him to get the bill paid in the next 30 days. But you know, I'll send him to a few owners now, and I mean, the first thing they're going to do is look at my win percentage, you know, and it's not good enough. Simple as that. I was laughing actually. a few weeks ago. Because I'm almost, you know, there's probably a few trainers like me that are almost afraid to look at their win percentage. But I think a few weeks ago I looked. I was trying to sell a horse at the time, and I sent it to a certain owner to have a look at. And his owner, his racing manager, emailed me back and said, "You know, your win percentage is 9%. It's not good enough for us to send you a horse." And I said, "Jesus, is that bad?" So I looked, and it was actually 11%, which is still bad. But I said, if you're going to kick a man while he's down, at least know what kind of kick you're going to give him, you know.
Yeah, you know, and those numbers, they really only tell a very small part of the story. You've kind of touched on some of the aspects that lead to having smaller numbers like that, and they only tell a small part. And that's why this show has been so instrumental for so many trainers in letting owners get to know them and get to know their approach and their philosophy and putting their horses with people like yourself, Connor, that they know will take good care of the horse first and foremost, which is what this sport should always be about.
Yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, you know, we're the majority of the guys in this game is our horse are very, you know, great horsemen to good horsemen, whatever, and you're, you know, everybody, the majority of people want to do what's right by the horse. You know, and that's the, at the end of the day, that's the most important thing. I mean, listen, it is what it is, you know. I mean, my win percentage is what it is, but, you know, I wouldn't change my approach from the point of view of, you know, doing certain things to change to try and win more, you know. So definitely the horses come first. That's the bottom line, you know.
Yep. Well, let's talk about, by the way, visiting with trainer Connor Murphy here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Let's talk about some of the success stories that you have had already in your career. And you've proven that when you get a horse that is stakes caliber, greatest stakes caliber, you can get it done and you can win the races with that horse. And I'm talking about Dimension in particular, the first horse you purchased after winning that big bet in 2012. He went on to win 3 grade 2 races. Tell me about Dimension.
Dimension was, he was a mighty horse for us because, you know, he was the flag bearer for us for a long time. And, you know, when I bought him, I kind of thought he'd be a very good miler over here, and you know he'd won from anywhere from 7 furlongs to 1.8 miles in England, and but you know the style of racing is so different in the two countries. I mean, you know, obviously at home in Ireland and in England as well, you know they break out of the gate and they're going a nice handy pace and they quicken the tempo towards, you know, throughout the race and finish off strong, whereas here you're obviously racing from gate to wire. So horses like Dimension, for example, who had won going 1.8 miles in Newmarket, which is a stiff 1.8 miles that you like horse. You know, I thought he'd get 1.8 miles here with the easier tracks, but you know, that was the first race I ran him was 1.8 miles and he just didn't get home because, you know, they obviously go that stride quicker here. And, you know, obviously we took him to Woodbine, where they have the 7 furlong graded stakes races. And yeah, sure, listen, he was a brilliant horse. I mean, his early years, especially with us, he rarely ran a bad race. I mean, look, he won 3 grade twos. He was, you know, second and third in numerous graded stakes. He was fifth in a Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint. I mean, you know, he's fifth in a Woodbine Mile. I mean, he was a brilliant horse. Got a bit cute towards the end of his career in that he'd, you know, he's still, you know, even 8, 9 year old. I mean, his 8 year old year was actually his best year. He won the Connacht Cup and the King Edward up in Woodbine that year. And you know, the following year he got a bit cute. He said, you know, if he wasn't on the going day, he'd pull himself up at the half mile pole. But I mean, he did win a stake in the fairgrounds a week before his 10th birthday, and he was a brilliant horse, and you take for granted at the time when you have them horses, you know how hard they are to get, you know.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. He turned out to be really good for you. He won 8 races from 45 starts in total for his career. He earned more than $600,000. And again, those 3 Grade 2 victories for Dimension. He also took you to the Breeders' Cup for the first time in 2013. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that was brilliant because, he'd won the King, or the Play the King Gun 7 at Woodbine, and I didn't really want, you know, I'd be honest to Mike, I wasn't keen to run him back in the Woodbine Mile, you know, not only because I didn't feel, I thought a mile might just stretch him at the time, and also Sirleason Wise Den was in his prime at the time, and Sirleason Wise Den is probably one of the greatest tough horses I've ever seen over here, and so I wasn't keen to run him in the Woodbine Mile, but anyway, sure, look, you get tempted and you get your arm twisted and all that, and we ended up running, and he ran well, he finished 5th, but you know, he just ran too keen out of the gate, and you know, straight after the race we said, you know, 6.5 furlong down the hill at Santa Anita should be ideal for him, and he ran a big race, he was finished 5th, beaten 3 lengths by Misdirection, so I mean, it was great. I mean, family over from Ireland, and sure, look, it was, you know, it's only a year after I'd left 7 Barrows, and you know, you're thinking, and I've often said this, you know, you just you kind of think this is how it's going to be, you know, and not in an arrogant way, but just you think, you know, you've gone from working with top horses in England, and you're lucky enough to have a Breeders' Cup runner in our first year training. You just think, oh, sure, this is great, you know, we'll be back again next year, which we were with him, but, you know, you think you're going to be back there most years, but by God, you don't be long learning that just these good horses are hard to come by, you know.
Yeah, I think every trainer goes through that, at least when they start fast. I remember Dwayne Lucas appearing on this program and telling the story of a horse that he took to it was a Triple Crown race, and the horse ran really well, didn't win, but came close. And he said, you know, heck, this was just an average horse. Can you imagine what's going to happen when we come back here with better horses? We're going to win a lot of these. And then he had to wait like 8 more years to get back there again. It'll spoil you when you have that early success, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, and, you know, we didn't take it for granted, but we just, you know, you think, you know, it's just you know, the horses, to have the horses good enough to go to the Breeders' Cup is so tough to get. There's no doubt about it, you know. Even to have a graded stakes horse is tough. So, yeah, we're just happy to get what we can now, you know.
Outside of Dimension, Connor, tell me about a couple of the other horses that really stand out to you when you think back on the horses that you've been around over the past 8 years or so.
Sure, look, I suppose Great White Open was a big, he was a very good horse for us. I mean, we bought him for, I think, 65 US maybe. And I mean, he won over 400,000. He won a stakes race. He was 2nd in the Shadwell Turf Mile. And, you know, we were hoping to get into the Breeders' Cup that year, as it was at Churchill, but we didn't get in, but, you know, that's the way it goes. And sure, I mean, he was a very good horse, and he's still around. He's not the horse he was, but he's a good horse with a bit of soft ground, you know. Sure, I suppose Emmaus. Now we're lucky to have Emmaus at the moment. Argentello is a good horse too, but he ran in Woodbine there a couple of weeks ago, and he was a bit disappointed, but he had a legitimate excuse after the race, but Emmaus, yeah, Emmaus seems to, you know, he could be Mr. Luck. He's yet to win a graded stake. He's been second. He's been second and third in a few, and he's was fifth in the Maker's Mark, and obviously fourth in Saratoga in the 4-star day of last Saturday. But you know, we just gelded him over the winter, and I feel he has moved up, and I think he will improve again over the next couple of runs. He's just with a bit of luck, I think he could be a good horse. Well, he is a good horse, but he could be very good if we can get a couple of breaks, you know.
I thought his race, talking about Emmaus, I thought his race in the 4-star Dave this past weekend was excellent. And, you know, again, he finished fourth, but he was beaten by Halliday, trained by Todd Pletcher, Got Stormy, who we know on her day is as good as it gets, and then Casa Creed. So he was finishing behind good horses and finished in front of Raging Bull, Without Parole, Uni, and Valid Point. Look, how does a trainer look at a performance like that, Connor, when you kind of split the field, but you beat really good horses?
Yeah, he ran well, Mike, there's no doubt about it. We just felt, we were a neck behind Raging Bull and Without Parole at Keeneland the previous race, and obviously overturned the farm with them. But, you know, we were very happy with the run, but I do think he's better than that. You know, I think, Jose Lescano rode him for the first time, and he gave him a very good ride. But I do think the horse is a better horse with some cover. The ground might have been a little on the quick side for him as well. But look, he always runs his race. He ran all the way to the line. So we were very happy with the run, but I do think he's better than that too, you know.
Visiting with trainer Connor Murphy here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Connor, we talked about your wife, Julia, and that relationship and her support that she has given you over the years. You also mentioned the two young children that you have. First of all, how old are they, and are they racing fans?
They're three-year-old twins, Jack and Sophie.
Oh, wow.
They love horses until you get to the barn. then they don't want anything to do with them. But I know it's a cliche, but sure, look, they changed my life. Without doubt, better than winning any bet or anything. They're definitely I know it's a cliche, but sure, they're the best thing to happen, no question. Because you know, a few years ago, and poor Julie got the brunt of it. But even if a race came off the grass, I'd be sulking for a couple of days over. When you've kids come along, it changes your whole, you know, outlook and everything. I mean, there's no point in me coming home telling them a horse ran bad if they just want me to turn on Mickey Mouse or whatever. They're not interested in my problems. But they're definitely been a big help. You know, like I said, they just make everything give a different aspect, absolutely.
Yeah, it certainly puts everything in perspective. There's no doubt about it. If they decide one day that they want to follow in Dad's footsteps and get involved in racing, what do you tell them?
I tell you what I'll do, Mike. I'll show them a picture of me before I start the training and a picture 5 years later. I'll say how older and fatter I got in the space of a few years from training and the stress and everything else, and that might change their mind. But if they want to get involved with racing, I'm not going to stand in their way of whatever they want to do, you know.
Well, Connor, listen, there's only a few minutes left here in the program, and I always like to end by asking trainers to let us know something about them that we haven't already talked about, that I haven't already asked you about. Maybe another hobby or an interest that you have outside of racing. What else do you enjoy doing?
When I'm not racing, I will obviously spend time with the family. But I'm a big soccer fan. Love them. I'm a huge Liverpool fan. There's a few of us there there's a few of us there in a WhatsApp group, actually, that have a bit of crack. We've got one poor Manchester United fan in there that's getting a lot of stick lately. But, no, yeah, I'd be a massive Liverpool fan, though, most of my life. And soccer would probably be the biggest thing outside racing that I'm interested in, you know.
Well, Connor, listen, it has been a delight to hear your story. This hour has flown by, and I know we could spend more time talking, but appreciate the visit. Want to wish you all the best moving forward with the family and with the horses that are in your care, and let's hope that there's more great stakes to follow. I have a feeling there's going to be.
Should we keep our fingers crossed anyway? Thanks a million, Mike.
All right, Connor Murphy here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Yeah, great story. I mean, great story as to how he was able to initially start to follow his dream, and now he's making that dream a reality. And you heard him, he was very candid. You heard him talk about having tough times. Every trainer has done that. Many trainers have come on this show over the years, and somehow they persevered, they've gotten through, and they come out even side. I have a feeling that's where Connor Murphy is going to end up very soon as well. Well, if you missed any portion of the show, head to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast. You can also follow us on social media, at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook and on Instagram. Now, for my special guest, Connor Murphy, for my producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to this edition of Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.